Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, the remains of 215 Indigenous children were found buried in unmarked graves at the site of a former Indian residential school in British Columbia. The Kamloops Indian Residential School operated from 1890 until the late 1970s. The Tecumseh Tishwaukma First Nations discovered the remains. Between 1883 and 1996, an estimated 150,000 Indigenous children in Canada were forced to attend residential schools, often far from their communities. Most were operated by churches, and all of them banned children from speaking their languages and taking part in their cultural practices. A National Truth and Reconciliation Commission set up by the Canadian government spent 6 years hearing from almost 7,000 witnesses to document the history of these schools. They heard accounts of violence, including physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. Diseases and malnutrition were also rampant. Hector McDonald, a former Kamloops student, spoke at a 2013 hearing saying, quote, "I learned a lot here. I learned how to hate. I learned how to steal. I learned how to fight. I learned how to cheat," end quote. In a 2015 report, the Canadian government concluded that the Indian residential school system was a form of cultural genocide. The commission identified 3,200 deaths in residential schools. The names of about a third of those students were not recorded. Indigenous communities have been demanding investigations at every former school site. How many more children are buried? Joining us to talk about this are two guests. Dr. Cindy Blackstock is a member of the Gitxsan First Nation with over 25 years of social work experience in child protection and Indigenous children's rights. Professor Blackstock is professor in the School of Social Work at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, an organization that works to ensure the safety and well-being of First Nations youth and their families. She has published more than 75 articles on topics including reconciliation and human rights. Hi, Cindy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
It's great to have you. Tanya Talega is an Ojibwe storyteller, writer, and filmmaker, and a columnist for The Globe and Mail. Her best-selling book, All Our Relations, Finding the Path Forward, explores the rise of youth suicide in Indigenous communities. She's also the author of the bestseller, Seven Fallen Feathers, Racism, Death, and Hard Truths in a Northern City, and hosts the podcast, Seven Truths. Tanya was asked by the Tecumseh Tishwaukma community to witness what was happening after the children were found, and her latest piece for the Globe and Mail is called "It's Time to Bring Our Children Home from the Residential Schools." Thank you so much for joining us, Tanya.
Ruzu, thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I'm actually really glad that we're doing this show after it got so much media attention, because I've been hearing from a lot of people that they're afraid this is now going to, you know, sort of die off a bit until the next children are found. So Cindy, can you talk about that? What is it going to take to keep this story alive?
Well, I think it really is a risk. And what we know is that Canada is not only not doing what it needs to do to implement the TRC's calls to action, that's the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's calls to action, to end the injustices. It's actually, as I'm sitting here, I'm in a law office because Canada is litigating against this generation of First Nations children to deprive them their rights. So the idea that people need to watch is really, really important, because Canada's colonial mindset that led to those 251 children being buried in unmarked graves and others yet to be found is the same kind of mindset that is driving them to fight against this generation of First Nations children.
And we'll talk about that later in the show, but I'm noticing that that is not getting that much attention. You have been working on this case for a long time. The Canadian government has been found to discriminate against First Nation kids by providing them with lesser services because they're First Nations. And this order came out back in 2016.
That's right. And it is really an order of systemic discrimination against the Canadian government. It really, what it amounts to is apartheid types of public services. And Tanya's We're very familiar with this in terms of the impacts on children and young people in education, where they're literally having to move hundreds of kilometers away from where they live just to go to high school. And then in Thunder Bay, seven or more youth have died in just trying to go to high school away from their families. So this type of discrimination is really here in Canada, but we haven't embraced it as a part of the Canadian identity. I think at least in the United States, there's been the Black Lives Matter movement, the civil rights movement that kind of brings the issues of systemic discrimination to the rise and people don't look away so quickly. But here in Canada, there's still the nice, we're a nice group identity that really makes it hard to grapple and square with Canada's conduct towards First Nations kids. So people look away.
Right. And we'll talk about that throughout the show. But Tanya, what would you add? What will it take to keep this story alive and on the front pages?
Miigwech for that. And I just want to take a moment to uphold Cindy Blackstock for the work that she does. She has been leading the way for many of our communities, for our children, for more than 14 years now. And you guys are actually really lucky to have her right now on the radio, I have to tell you, because she's really she's been at the center of the storm. And she has taught me as well. Her words, and they inspire me greatly. I want to say that I know that our communities, I know that our survivors and our elders and our people will do everything they can to not let the story die. And I hope that continues. Like, for example, I just got off of a call with many survivors and leadership from communities across Ontario, figuring out how we're going to go forward from here, how we recognize the fact that, you know, just taking the province, for example, of Ontario, 18 residential schools, but there were so many more. You know, officially, Canada, through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was put forward to listen to all of the survivors of the schools that wanted to share their stories and tell their stories, over 7,000 people were listened to. This incredible report was published, which you referenced in 2015. And, you know, one of the volumes of that report led with our children, our missing children. And the numbers that are in the report are, 3,200, I think it is, that is just a fraction. What we believe is that it's at least four times that many. So many of our children just disappeared. They ran away and weren't heard of again. They were taken in the middle of the night. And so many of our families hold these stories of children that just were gone. And this is now a moment. And I think that to Kamloops, to Shwapna, they are the ones that, you know, knew the stories, decided to go forward and look and found the 215 children, undocumented children. And they now have awoken something all throughout the country, something that we've been living with, but something that we're all now listening to now, and that desire to bring our children home, whatever capacity that looks like, you know, according to communities' wishes, because children were sent over such long, huge geographical divides. You know, I know of children that went from 2,000 kilometers away to another school.
Tanya, you were asked by the community to witness what was happening. Can you tell us how they actually found these children?
Yes, the community would be best to speak to that. But radar was used to find them, ground penetrating radar. And the community knew the stories of their children were missing and they were possible in these unmarked graves. So they began to search. And that is what they found. And the community has just come forward with preliminary results so far, but there will be a further release of an in-depth study. in the coming weeks as to exactly even how many children there will be.
Cindy, in past interviews, you have said that the government of Canada needs to make available the latest technologies to search for additional children. Can you talk more about that and what that would look like?
Sure. So as Tanya is saying, no one knows the real number of children who were buried on these residential schools. We do know, as Tanya is alluding, that the number is much higher than what has been documented so far. For example, there is a report from 1907 by Canada's own chief medical health officer that links the inequalities in federal health care to the prolific death rates in the schools, as high as 25% or 50% if you followed the kids over 3 years. And this doctor named Dr. Bryce said, fix these healthcare inequalities and practice good health practices and you could save their lives. And he was documenting the number of deaths. But when Canada learned of his report, they retaliated against him. And even though it was leaked in the media at the time and headlines read, the children are dying like flies, absolute inattention to the bare necessities of health, the public attention did not last long enough and it fell off the pages. And Canada, as part of its retaliation, stopped the keeping of those death statistics. So what we need to do is really rely on the truths that are being shared by the survivors. And I have been to many residential schools, as has Tanya, or the grounds of residential schools. And if you listen to the survivors and their truths, they tell you where they are. Mm-hmm. That's true in Kamloops, too. They knew the children were there. All they needed was the technology and the available investment to make sure that they could locate those children and then be equipped with the services to help the community honor their spirits and to go through a grieving process. Because in many cases, this is really what it's bringing up, is the loss of these children, the fact that they died going to school. And I should say, Rose, our residential schools are an export of the United States. The guy who started the residential schools went down to Carlisle Industrial School in Pennsylvania, and that's where the model for residential schools in Canada came from.
Right. I'm glad you raised that, because we're going to talk about that on tomorrow's show to learn about the history of these schools and what's going on in the United States, because there's been no acknowledgement in this country. And so that's our topic tomorrow. The other issue, Cindy, that's important to talk about here is records. You brought this up briefly. Can you talk more about what the Vatican can do? You have also said that the Vatican can return documents from Rome back to Canada so they can be examined and they might be able to identify these children. We were reading a report from CTV that said the Canadian government destroyed 15 tons of paper documents related to the residential school system between 1936 and 1944, including 200,000 Indian Affairs files. So can you talk about the importance of these documents?
Well, that's a way that we can trace what happened to these kids. And to the degree we can, hold accountable the perpetrators of wrongdoing and indeed of manslaughter or murder. And it is vital that we have these documents to be able to locate and honor these children and find out how they died. So the Vatican may well have many of these documents in its Vatican library. And Catholic dioceses here in Canada have not fully disclosed their records, nor has the government of Canada. You're right in saying that they destroyed all those records. But in a case that Tanya and I are both familiar with, regarding survivors from St. Anne's Residential School, that literally Rose had an electric chair where they would put the children in, and yeah. Canada has the records. It withheld those records from the survivors until the time period for the survivors to be able to make a claim under a class action expired. And now they're saying that they don't qualify. So this kind of not forking over the records is a problem both with the Catholic Church, but also with the government of Canada.
And I should say that some of the things we're going to talk about might be distressing to listeners, but we really need to put all of this on the record. and, you know, bring this out for people to learn about. In the CCTV or CTV report, Mike Kachagi attended three separate residential schools in Northern Ontario, but there are few records to prove it. And in an interview, he said, all the records of me going there, my attendance, everything was at the hands of my captors, the church and Canada. He said it was very inhumane. You've got 70 or 80 or 100 in assembly with a child in a wooden box, no one mourning, no one crying. And Tanya, when you watch documentaries and listen to the stories, some of these children say that their friends took their own lives. Some children burned down the schools. Some children said they witnessed people being buried in mass sites. And then this one is absolutely horrific. Infants who were born to young girls who'd been fathered by priests had those infants taken away and thrown into furnaces. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are horrendous stories, and they have been documented.
Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that you're just hearing about, right? I mean, right. Those are the ones we're talking about. But for every single one of those, there's probably 10 others that we're not hearing about at all. I mean, this is the issue. This is the problem. And as Cindy has said, we have had a country, I would like to say a continent, you know, we could talk about the continent of Turtle Island that has a history of looking away, right? This is a continent born on violence. It was born from contact, from the policies in the United States of extermination by U.S. President Andrew Jackson, you know, to slavery. It's a violence we continue to see, and especially when it comes to our people, you know, on both sides of the border. There were policies put in place in the United States and in Canada to remove us, to extinguish us, to assimilate us in order to take the land and to settle, right? So we were all moved off into reservations or reserves. And this is all connected to the story that we're still telling now, that we're still trying to tell. You know, people often talk in Canada about reconciliation, and we're still at the point of truth-telling, of getting our stories out, like getting the stories out of what has happened at these schools. And you can look at these schools as yet another example of the genocidal policies of these colonial governments. And so how does one make amends? How do we make amends now in this country? How do we move forward? Moving forward means telling the truth, listening to those survivors, listening to those communities that say there are 5 unmarked graves here near this certain school. Many of the schools, the sites in Canada, I know, and in Ontario, there were multiple grave sites, unmarked grave sites. And those sites now must all be searched and remembered, the children remembered. And Cindy, you know, talked about the spiritual work involved. And I know that Chief Roseanne Casimir, who is in Kamloops, she's very much aware that it is her nation, her people now, who are taking care of the spirits of those 215 children. And now we have children all over the country that need to be taken care of. And what do we do with their spirits now? How do we bring them home? What does that look like? Those are the questions we have to ask ourselves as community members and find a way forward.
Tanya Talegai is an Ojibwe storyteller, writer, filmmaker, and columnist with the Globe and Mail. Dr. Cindy Blackstock is a member of the Gitxon First Nation with over 25 years of social work experience in child protection and Indigenous children's rights. We're talking today about the news last month that a mass gravesite of 215 Indigenous children had been discovered at the former Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia. Indigenous communities are demanding investigations at every former school site. How many more children are buried? And as Tanya says, how does one make amends? If you have any questions for our guests, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Cindy, we have about 5 minutes left with you, so let's bring this to the present. We talked about the report that came out that found the Canadian government discriminates against First Nations kids by providing them with lesser services. So Canada admits its behavior created unnecessary family separation, it harmed children, and contributed to the deaths of children. Can you give us an update on this? What has been the result of this report that came out?
Yeah, it was actually legal rulings. This was after a 72-day trial. Canada threw everything it could to try and get the case dismissed, and then it tried every legal technicality during the trial. But in 2016, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ordered Canada to cease its discriminatory practices because it was driving kids into foster care unnecessarily, harming kids, and even contributing to the deaths of children. Canadian politicians came out and welcomed the hearing and then the decision, and then they didn't do anything. So we're now up to 19 non-compliance and procedural orders against the government as we're trying to get them to realize this order. The good news is, thanks to all this litigation, First Nations kids are receiving about close to a million services that they would not have received otherwise, and child welfare agencies and community are finally getting some prevention funding. But Canada continues to fight. And this week, the federal government has taken First Nations kids to court because the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal said that the harm that these kids experienced was of a worst case scenario resulting from Canada's willful and reckless behavior. And each child ought to receive $40,000. Canada does not want to pay that. Then the second one is that Canada's been ordered to make sure that First Nations children off reserve get access to the public services they need when they need them. And Canada doesn't want that either. So there was a House of Commons motion passed unanimously last week telling the government to drop these two cases, but they're not doing it, even though there's been a huge groundswell of support from Canadians to drop the litigation. Canada continues to fight against these kids. And at issue at these hearings that are about to resume in just a couple of minutes is the two of the top three TRC's calls to action. So Canada's literally fighting against those as well.
Cindy, what should people in the U.S. know about how First Nations children are treated? Is it similar to here? I mean, you've said that some nations don't have clean drinking water. Many don't have schools. You know, if there was more reporting on what happens on reservations in the United States, I think people would be pretty outraged because the Navajo Nation, for example, did not have running water during COVID. So what do you want people in the U.S. to know about First Nations children?
What we have in Canada is apartheid public services. Racial discrimination is fiscal policy towards First Nations children. And I know that there is something very similar in the United States towards Native American peoples. And this type of public service delivery is intentional. And it is very much the same mindset that drove those children into those residential schools and resulted in them perishing and being buried in those unmarked graves. So we have to stand up for equity for our kids. We need to educate the people and the public about these pieces. The fact that if you're a First Nations child in Canada, you get less on everything compared to other people. And then we need to use whatever legal instruments or peaceful social protest tools we have at our disposal to force the government to change. Because colonial governments don't create change, they respond to change. And that's why the Canadian public or the U.S. public have such a critical role in this. They have to tell their member of the legislature that there is no place in their societies for racial discrimination as fiscal policy in 2021, especially towards kids.
Well, I know we have to let you go to watch this case. So, Cindy, thank you so much for all of the incredible work that you've done. And thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Hey, thank you, Rose. And, you know, it's an honor to be on the same show as Tanya. So all the best to you.
Love and strength to you right now, Cindy.
Thank you so much. Dr. Cindy Blackstock is a member of the Gitxaun First Nation with over 25 years of social work experience in child protection and Indigenous children's rights. She's a professor in the School of Social Work at McGill University in Montreal and executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. You can find more information about her incredible work at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will continue speaking with Tanya Talega, an Ojibwe storyteller, writer, filmmaker, and columnist with The Globe and Mail. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the roots of Indigenous boarding schools in the United States, which were a model for Canada's residential schools. The United States has not kept documentation about the true number of schools, but historians say there were more than 350. Researchers also believe that there are similar burial sites here in the United States. Indigenous communities are calling on the United States to finally acknowledge its role in attempting, we should use that word attempting, to destroy Native families, cultures, and languages. Today, we are talking about what is happening in Canada. You have probably heard by now that last month, the remains of 215 Indigenous children were found buried in unmarked graves at the site of the Kamloops Indian Residential School, which operated from 1890 until the late 1970s. It was in British Columbia. And now we are going to play a clip of residential school survivors. This is from a CBC News documentary called Stolen Children, Residential School Survivors Speak Out.
My name is Alice Little Deer. I'm 78 years old. I spent about 8 years in residential school.
My name is Raymond Mason. I'm 62 years old, and I attended residential school for 12 years.
I'm Madeline Dion Stout. I'm 62 years old. I'm from the Kehewan First Nation in Alberta. I attended Blue Quills Residential School for 36 consecutive months. That would be 3 years.
In order to educate the children properly, we must separate them from their families. Some people may say that this is hard, but if we want to civilize them, we must do that. A federal cabinet minister, 1883.
I remember them taking me away from my mother and my stepfather. And I can hear them telling my mom that that was the best thing for me, you know, and that not to worry, I would be looked after.
Our parents didn't want to worry us unduly and tell us and warn us that we are going to be separated for a long, long time with barely a visit.
I see him come around, Indian agent in a boat, with the principal, and then collect some children from the reserve. Mm-hmm. Then he would come back again and come and take some more.
So the next day, I woke up with hundreds of total strangers, my size, my age, and not knowing, you know, what are they doing with all of us here? Why are there so many of us here, you know? And that's where a lot of my whole life really started to change, because I got strapped, I got beaten up for speaking my own native tongue. I even had my tongue pulled out and pinched, you know.
My strongest memory there is when the little girl died beside me. She must have been about six. I was scared why the parents were not there. That's what I was scared about. And I knew they wouldn't feel comfortable for not being there when their daughter's dying.
And do you know why they weren't there?
They were never notified.
Indian children in the residential schools die at a much higher rate than in their villages. But this does not justify a change in the policy of this department, which is geared towards a final solution of our Indian problem. Duncan Campbell Scott, Deputy Superintendent of Indian Affairs.
That is from a CBC News documentary called Stolen Children, Residential School Survivors Speak Out. And today we are talking about this with Tanya Talega, an Ojibwe storyteller, writer, filmmaker, and columnist for the Globe and Mail. She's the author of two best-selling books, All Our Relations, Finding the Path Forward, which explores the rise of youth suicide in Indigenous communities in Canada, and author of Seven Fallen Feathers, Racism, Death, and Hard Truths in a Northern City. Tanya also hosts the podcast Seven Truths. Tanya, are the details getting a lot of attention? Because I think when you really kind of sit back and think about what people have gone through, the most horrific is obviously the rape, the abuse, and then some survivors say they just were not properly fed. They were fed food that was so different from what they were used to, and they experienced malnutrition, and they threw up. They were not clothed properly. Their hair was cut if they had long braids. I mean, are these details getting attention right now?
I think they are. I think that a lot of media reports have focused on the survivors' stories and mm-hmm. things that people are talking about. But, you know, it's so hard. You know, I don't know if people really absorb the gravity of what it was like in these schools. I mean, Cindy spoke of St. Anne's residential school that was run by Oblate nuns along the James Bay coast, and how there was a homemade electric chair that was used there to discipline and punish the students. I can tell you that in some of the schools, like Cecilia Jeffrey Indian Residential School, which is in Kenora, Ontario, just across from the Minnesota border, the students were medically experimented on. They withheld certain foods, gave them other foods to see if nutrient deficiencies, how it would affect their bodies. There was widespread stories too in Ontario of dental experiments, of children receiving lots of dental surgery without any painkillers whatsoever. The stories are endless. The stories of neglect, the stories of not clothing the kids properly at all for the harsh winters that we have. And you're right, when students were put into the schools, and some of the kids were so young when they were put into the schools, like I spoke to a survivor at Kamloops, and just so your listeners are aware, the Kamloops Indian Residential School is where the North and South Thompson Rivers, the confluence of those rivers, so it's in near the Fraser River Valley system. It's north of Washington State there. And this one of the survivors, his name is Norm, he was telling me about how he was 5 years old when he was playing in a field near his parents. A truck drove by, stopped at the side of the road, and plucked him up and stuck him in the truck and took him away. I mean, this is kidnapping. And we see this time and time again. Apparently, the truck went around and just snatched the children and took them to the school. In Canada, the police forces, the RCMP, were used quite a bit to take our children away and to stick them into the residential schools. These are stories that we see played out to the present day, the effects of those stories, because now our communities don't trust police. A lot of our communities have issues with the RCMP that date back to those times and those memories. I mean, Norm, for instance, is 76 years old. You know, these are our elders. There are people like this isn't something that happened, 1,000 years ago. This isn't something that happened 200 years ago. The last school in Canada closed in 1996. My mother was raised by survivors. Her grandparents were survivors, And the effects of that trauma, the intergenerational trauma, is seen with us to today. And so when we hear these stories of, you know, malnutrition and of rape and of horrific abuse, all of us feel it, because every single First Nations person in the United States and in Canada, you're connected to the school somehow.
Right. Well, to add to what you're saying, the nature of us shared Eddie Charlie's story. He's a survivor of the Cooper Island Residential School, which was near Vancouver Island. And he talked about just the horrific amount of sexual and physical abuse. He said, "It got so bad so frequent that I tried committing suicide while I was in the school. I couldn't handle it anymore. They were picking kids off the floor and taking them up to a room where they were abused." He wrote, "When I came home, I started fighting with my family. I didn't feel like I had a home. I didn't feel like I was part of a family. So I tried to find ways to deal with the anger and the pain, started drinking when I was very young, and it became my coping mechanism for 30 years of my life." And he said he quit drinking about 25 years ago, and for the first time ever, he started to understand why he changed, and he started to look at the effects of the schools. So that's the other piece of this. What about all of the survivors and how they're coping and dealing with this? Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about that and what resources are available for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, really hard. And thanks for asking that question. Because I told you the story about Norm being taken away from his family. So I met Norm in Kamloops, and I've chatted with him on the phone, you know, a couple of times. And sometimes he just wants to talk. He wants his story told. And we have survivors all across this country that are, you know, they're reliving all of this. And so that's one of the things we've all been thinking about and talking about is as we go forward and, you know, beyond Kamloops and all of the other at least 140 schools that were in Canada, we have to be very mindful of our survivors as they reopen up all these wounds again and remember what happened to them, or remember their missing friends or siblings. And, you know, and it brings everything back. And it's really, it is a really heavy time right now for many of us, almost all of us. I mean, this has affected so many. It's even hard to put into words what that feels like, that what that spiritual weight feels like. And if that's what it's like for me, what's it like for our survivors and our elders, right? Mm. And when you ask about supports put in place, we did have supports a while ago that were, the survivors did, that were associated with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but those have ended. So our elders, our survivors need support now, for sure. And that is something we're all incredibly mindful of as we go forward in the work of finding the children.
When you talk to survivors, what do they say about the kind of support that they need?
I think that varies, and that'll vary from survivor to survivor, from community to community of what they need. But definitely a place that they can turn to, a place that is practicing ceremony and protocol and a safe space, right? A safe space where stories can be shared, or a safe place to just go sit in and just reflect and remember. And, you know, it means many things for many people. I mean, some people, they heal by doing, like Norm, I was talking about him earlier. He makes drums. Hmm. He's like 76, and he makes hand drums constantly. So he keeps making them and making them because he needs to have his mind going, right? Like he needs to keep working through all of those emotions. Hmm.
Today we're speaking with Tanya Talega, an Ojibwe storyteller, writer, filmmaker, and columnist for the Globe and Mail. And we are talking about the fallout from the 215 Indigenous children whose remains were found buried in unmarked graves at the site of a former Indian residential school in British Columbia. What will it take to keep this story alive? How does one make amends around all of this? If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Sean in San Francisco couldn't stay on the line, but he said, why is the Roman Catholic Church so bloody evil? And the other thing that Cindy brought up in one of her interviews is she said that in the documents that need to be sent back to Canada, we need to learn what happened to these perpetrators. Are they still out there abusing children? What are your thoughts on that, Tanya?
Yep. I mean, those are really good questions, aren't they? I mean, part of the thing with the fact is that when these kids died, I mean, what happened to the records? Did anybody write it down? Were records kept? We don't know in a lot of the situations because, as Cindy was saying, it was the Catholic Church that that ran most of the schools in Canada and are the holders of most of the records. And they have not been forthcoming with the record release. You know, the leadership of the church, actually, I was a cardinal in Toronto that was talking about it about a week ago. And he said, you know, we gave the documents that were requested of us. I beg to differ on that one. Like, I know that if you go to certain dioceses, like all of these little dioceses all over the place, they have records. They have records of children. They have records of who went where they were from. And those are still sitting in basements. We're talking about millions of records, too. And we can't prosecute and find out about these kids and what happened to them if we don't go about finding them in the correct way and reading the records. Just a little example. So it's not just like we can't just go and like say you find somebody's body, so you have an unmarked grave. You have to excavate that site properly. An archaeologist has to do that before somebody just goes in and takes the bones away, mm-hmm. because you need to gather evidence as to what happened to that child, right? So you have evidence to say, well, this is what happened that corroborates the story of someone being killed by one of the people at the school, or someone that was beaten to death. You know, you hear all of these stories, and how do you know without the evidence?
Right. And this is so, so important. And you have Pope Francis saying he was pained by the discovery, but did not come out and apologize. And then you have Justin Trudeau saying that the Catholic Church must take responsibility for its role mm-hmm. and provide records to help identify remains. So is the Canadian government putting pressure on the church to provide these records?
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure they are, because this is the thing that the Canadian government understands, is that the Canadian government is the one that sanctioned the churches to run the schools. The Canadian government funded these schools. The churches ran the schools. So they know that they have a moral and ethical, I would hope they know, they have a moral and ethical obligation to force the churches to open up their records. You know, it is the right thing to do in this, and at any time, really, it is the right thing to do. I mean, we're talking about thousands of children that have died. There has to be an apology from the church, and it has to be done in Canada. It has to be done in North America. You know, I think it's one of the things that the church has said as well. It's like, oh, we already apologized to Indigenous people about the crimes that we did in the Americas, 14 years ago. I'm sorry. I don't recall an apology by the Pope standing at the site of Kamloops Indian Residential School, or standing at the site of the Kenora, one of the schools in Kenora, or St. Anne's. You know, it has to be done. It's just the right thing to do. And, you know, it's, I hear the Pope when he's saying, you know, I'm thinking of us, but he won't go that extra mile. And why is that? Mm. Afraid of litigation? Hmm. Afraid to say sorry? Is that what this is? I'm sorry. I think that so much more could be done. And how the church has responded is frankly just criminal.
We have a question about litigation from a caller. Let's go to Glenn in San Francisco. Hi, Glenn. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. This is Glenn. Yeah, you said what else could be done. And my question is, are there any suits to compensate the victims or their families in a monetary way? There's so many egregious acts here by the church, by the governments. And I'm glad you also said the U.S. is not with clean hands either. So thank you for the show. It's great.
Thank you, Glenn. I hope you can tune in tomorrow. We'll be talking about the United States. What can you tell us, Tanya? There have been class action lawsuits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the big one to know about, the big settlement to know about, is the Indian Residential School Survivors settlement that took place alongside the TRC. And money was given out to survivors of the schools, but not in every case. You know, we have actually just settled. So we have the residential schools. There were 140 recognized by the Government of Canada to be part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But in actual fact, we understand that there were more like 1,300 schools. So many schools didn't get to be a part of that settlement. Survivors didn't get to be a part of what is happening. And for example, the school we were talking about earlier, St. Anne's, that had the homemade electric chair, the survivors have been fighting the Canadian government, and the Canadian government to this day is still fighting those survivors over what happened in the school and compensating them for the unbelievable abuse that happened in that particular school. That school was, you know, many of them were very heinous, but that one was in particular. And imagine that the Canadian government is taking survivors to court and has been for years. It's appalling. It truly is. And it would be so great, you know, I know you guys are talking about it tomorrow, but it would be great to see if the U.S. goes through a similar process. I think it was in 1879 that the U.S. government introduced the first Indian boarding school. As Cindy said, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania. That was founded by Captain Richard Henry Pratt. And he believed that all Indians were born, quote unquote, blank, and that the removal from their cultural and traditional family structure would allow them to be assimilated and modeled into, quote unquote, Americans. Mm. It's the exact same situation in Canada.
It's so hard. It's going to be hard for me to do that one tomorrow because my grandparents are survivors. My great-grandmother went to a boarding school. Luckily, she didn't stay very long, but her language died because of that short experience. They would beat kids who spoke their language, and she never taught it to her kids because she was afraid that they would also be beaten. I mean, languages die in a short amount of time. Grandparents never talked about it, so we don't really know what happened. But I think this is similar with a lot of families where they just don't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep, totally. Like that was in my family too. I mean, my mom was raised by survivors, as I said, and it was the same thing. She, you know, they wouldn't talk about what happened at the school. All my mom was raised, you know, being a good Catholic. That was the most important thing, right? Is to not talk about anything Indian because that was dirty.
Right.
Right. And that was, where does that come from? That comes from what her grandmother was taught in the school. And language, Anishinaabewewin, which is our language, was only to be spoken outside. Like you couldn't speak it in the house. She wouldn't let it be spoken in the house, right? I mean, so you're right. That's how languages die. And all across North America, all of our languages are at risk of dying because of the schools on both sides of the border.
Mm. Tanya, where is this going? I wanted to also ask you, we're almost out of time, but Edgerton Ryerson, one of the architects of Canada's residential school, a statue of Ryerson was toppled at Ryerson University in Toronto. I mean, a major university in Toronto is named after this person. And I understand that you're going to get an honorary doctorate from this school, and there's a campaign to actually change the name of this school.
Yep. And thanks for bringing that up. So a little story, the community, as you guys heard at the beginning of the hour, asked me, and Kamloops asked me to go out and to bear witness and tell the story of what was happening out there. And I'm still in the process of doing that. I got on a plane to come home, and I came home to the toppling, the news of the toppling of the statue of Egerton Ryerson, who was one of the architects of the Indian residential school system in this country. And I actually wrote a column today in the Globe and Mail about the fact that I am getting an honorary doctorate and what that means to me as a descendant of survivors of the schools, and how we have to stop upholding the names of these guys, right? Because they're mostly all guys, like Sir John A. Macdonald, a founding father, quote unquote, of Canada, Duncan Campbell Scott, another architect of the residential school system, Egerton Ryerson. We have statues, we have monuments, we have their faces on the backs of dollar bills, you know, or of our currencies, I should say. And when I see these things, I see a reminder of the criminality of Canada's past and how I will never feel wholly a part of the country as a result of that, right? And these things have to be torn down. I mean, there are 80,000 First Nations people living in Toronto. I mean, can't we call it the City University instead?
Well, you know, we're out of time, but there's, as you say, so much educating needs to be done, so much change needs to be done, and it's really been amazing to meet you on the radio. Thank you so much for all of your great work, and we'd love to have you back.
Chimigwech, and I'd love to come back anytime, and as such, I'm going to say Bumapi, which means I will see you soon.
Thank you. Tanya Talega is an Ojibwe storyteller, writer, filmmaker, and columnist with The Globe and Mail. Find her work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.